Welcome to iConversations. I'm Petra Stoffberg, co-founder of Wardrobe Icons, and today I'm in the heart of New York's financial district at the Tivy offices to talk to founder and creative director, Amy Smilovic. We first met Amy back in April last year when we interviewed her for the cover story of the Icons update, and both Laura and I were blown away by her. The word we've picked for Amy is authenticity. As the founder of a successful global fashion brand that continues to thrive in a notoriously fickle industry, 22 years after launching, she certainly knows a thing or two about the subject. Starting out in the advertising world, before moving into the fashion space, Amy's story is one of true authenticity and the power of staying true to oneself. I wanted to dig a little bit deeper into the story of how she built Tibby from the ground up, to find out her secret to longevity and ask what advice she'd impart to fellow entrepreneurs. I hope the conversation gives you food for thought. Enjoy. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
So for our listeners, I thought I would just set the scene a little bit. We're here at Tibby's head office with Amy Smilovic, who is the head designer and founder of the brand in the heart of the financial district, am I right, in New York?
Yeah.
At the beautiful sort of open plan office. So Amy, we met you and we did a cover shoot with you in Paris. Laura in fact shot you, I didn't have the honor. We loved the interview that you did with Deborah, and so we really wanted the opportunity to speak to you in podcast format, which you kindly agreed to. Yes. When we came to New York. So I think I'll just kick it off by asking you to tell us a bit about your history, because you didn't actually study fashion. In fact, you started your career as an advertising executive. So What made you make that shift?
Well, I started out in advertising at Ogilvy and Mather, and then American Express was my client, and I moved to American Express. That's where I met my husband, and he was also at American Express and got transferred to Hong Kong. So when we moved to Hong Kong, I was in a position where I would have had to have been reporting to him, which just for a million reasons would not have worked out. In my mind, I thought it was the time when I could start my own company. And I had always wanted to start my own company. And it wasn't always a fashion company that I wanted to start. I just knew that I wanted my own business. So that was really important to me, to start my own company at some point in my life. And if we were moving to Hong Kong, I was 29 at the time, I guess. And I really just thought, you know, this is a place where no one's going to be looking over my shoulder. I can do what I want. And I really just took stock of what I knew how to do. And I knew how to do marketing. And I had an art minor. And I loved fashion. And I knew business. And I was in Hong Kong. Like, what better place to be to start a clothing company? And that's what I did.
So basically, you just felt like it wasn't so much that clothing or fashion called to you, it was more that the business side of fashion
in the beginning you. It was, yes, definitely the business side of fashion that attracted me. Like, I wanted to make money so that I could buy designer brands. Not like to wear my own clothing at the time. It was like, I want to be phenomenally successful so I can buy like more Donna Karen.
Did you use any of the skills that you learned as an advertising executive when you shifted over to owning your own fashion business?
Yeah, I definitely did. And I think that's what made the brand very unique in the beginning, because this was the late 1990s. So if you went into fashion, you were either like someone whose dad had like a button factory in New Jersey, or you were someone who had gone to Parsons or Central St. Martin's. And that was really it. You know, there were just like two routes in this business. And so living in Hong Kong, I didn't know that there were two routes. I wasn't in the business. I just knew that I thought that it could be a good business. And being in advertising certainly helped, because it was my instinct. Of course, when I made my first, you know, few pieces of clothing, of course I was going to do a direct mail campaign around it, and I was going to do a little booklet showing everything. And that was something that later on I found out that a lot of stores, when they agreed to see my line and when they signed on, they assumed that I had been in business for years, because they were like, who right out of design school does, you know, a little ad campaign and direct mail and that kind of stuff? It just wasn't done at the time.
So in a way, it gave you a leg up in terms of experience that maybe younger designers obviously wouldn't have had in some ways.
But to the stores, they saw me as established and credible. Mm. So I wasn't to them some young designer kind of pounding the pavement with a box full of dresses.
Yeah.
They actually thought I was very established. You know, they had no idea I was working out of my apartment in Hong Kong. And
I mean, you launched in 1997, is that right? Mm-hmm. And so it's been a growing business for 22 years. What would you say in such a, you know, notoriously fickle environment has been the secret to your longevity?
Staying independent has been huge because it... You know, every day we wake up and we're really working off of our instincts, and our instincts are good. I hire really good people, and we're very curious about the world and what's happening in it. So, you know, when we see change, you know, when you work for a bigger business and you see change happening, it's kind of like, as employees, you go to a bar afterwards and you bitch about what your company's doing. You know, you're like, oh my God, if they only knew, like, I don't even look at that TV show anymore. And we're, you know, like you bitch about it, but you're not able to actually walk in and do something.
Well, you're not in control of it because you've got shareholders and people to answer to, and their expectations, hopes, dreams, vision all gets wrapped up into the product.
Exactly. And so, you know, being able to, you know, see a change and know that you need to react to it, and that by react to it, you can even talk in timelines of hours or days, but certainly not like 6 months and years like other companies have to do. That's a huge advantage.
And have you found it difficult to stay independent? Because I know myself and Nara, we constantly, not constantly, but from time to time, the issue of, you know, investment and raising more money, and you know, we get approached by bigger companies and so on, and we always hold back because there is this love of being able to be independent. Yeah. But obviously that comes with its challenges, and you know, there are certain elements of being independent which is very difficult. Have you, over the years, has there been like sort of moments where you've thought, I just want to just have a bigger company, you know, for cash flow? Or
I think that there are only problems with staying independent depending on what you're reaching for. So I think that if I was, you know, if I was really putting pen to paper and saying I want to be $150 million in a few years, no, I don't think I could do that through an independent route. You know, it would really take some big investments in order for me to scale like that. So I think it is about how comfortable you are being small, you know, and knowing that, you know, right now I'm not on a trajectory to have a fleet of private jets, and that's okay with me. And so so I'm okay then with staying independent if that means that, you know, the trade-off is that I may not get the fleet of jets.
Yes. Well, not yet.
Or one jet. It's tough being independent as you grow because, of course, your variable and your operating expenses, you know, go up, and that's what keeps you up at night is, you know, before I would lay in bed at night and I could always do all of my expenses and my revenue in my head. And I could always do the math, and I knew that if I landed positive, then I could, like, fall asleep. Now, that math is just like frightening to me. I would never try and do it in bed at night. So yeah, the risk gets really higher as you grow. And so yes, staying independent is a struggle because if you do stumble, the numbers are very big now. So stumbling could take you out of business very quickly.
Yeah. You underwent a brand overhaul in 2010, mm-hmm. Where you moved away from the initial aesthetic of mm-hmm. the brand and towards its current cleaner aesthetic, very similar to what Amy is actually wearing today, in a beautiful leather skirt that I'm incredibly jealous of, and a very stylish cream jumper. you described this move as something that was more true to yourself. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a bit about this process and, you know, what was the catalyst for change?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, when you say that I moved from one position to another, I think the problem was pre-2010 is that we never really had a brand position, because when I started out, it was a company that was really just based on trends of the moment. And then what happened is that, you know, maybe in 2003, we went into like a real vintage printed dress trend. And so then all of a sudden, that point of which where you establish yourself with your sales is, back in the day, it's when the department stores then would grab on and say, aha, this is what sells, therefore this is what you are. So every time the department stores came in, they were like, oh, we need more of those printed floral vintage dresses. And I was like, well, yeah, but I mean, I hate those dresses now. You know, I've moved on to this. And they're like, no, you know, that's what sells. That's what you are. If you want our business, you make more of those. And at the time I was like, all right, well, you know, I want their business, so I'm going to make more. And we got into a cycle where the department stores would come in and they would tell you what they were doing really well with from you, from other brands, and that's what you would go and create for them. And then all of a sudden the stores would come to you and they would say, well, those floral dresses didn't sell so well, so now we need to return them. And I'm like, for cripes, like, you're the one that designed them to begin with. Now I gotta, like, take them all back. And so I was experiencing this on that side. And then at the other time, you had fast fashion coming down the pike. And we were in this contemporary price point where I was like, why would I buy a Tibby Top if I could buy something similar as Zara for, you know, 1/100th of the price? And it just, the price value difference really wasn't there in that contemporary world. So I realized that I needed to really separate myself from what was happening in fast fashion and what was happening in contemporary. I needed to have a point of view. I needed to make sure that I had a brand that was authentic, not because authentic was a buzzword in 2010, but because it was the only thing I knew how to do. Like, I wasn't going to pivot to some other fake thing. You know, I needed to pivot to now, like, what I really knew and what was inside me.
And did you find any, like, resistance to that? Because obviously that's quite, like, if you'd gone from being a brand that had quite a, say, like, a more
floral girly
aesthetic, mm-hmm. to suddenly going like quite pared back and minimal.
I had resistance in different pockets. So, like, internally, my head of design, Tracy, she had come from Donna Karan. You know, she and I were always like, whenever we had to do an interview, we would go put on our Tibby dresses. It was never anything that we that was part of us. So, you know, when I gave her complete freedom to create the line that she'd always wanted to create, you know, there were, like, you know, she was ecstatic beyond belief. And most of the people in the office, I was always hiring people who shared my personal aesthetic.
Yes.
They didn't ever match the Tibby aesthetic, so they were excited about the change. Then there were people like Net-a-Porter. I remember my buyer at Net-a-Porter, it was Holly Rogers at the time, who's gone on to do a million other things.
I think she's at Browns now, actually.
Yeah. And I remember Holly one time when I came in, she was like, Amy, you dress so much cooler than your brand. Why is this not your brand? And I was always wearing, like, before, you know, we would always do our prototypes in, like, blacks and whites and creams. I would wear, like, a lot of our prototypes. And she was like, why is this not what you're doing? So I think that the buyers who knew me personally and they knew my personal style, they were really excited when that's what the brand became about. Those who didn't, you know, I remember there was my buyer at Saks Fifth Avenue at the time, and she was just like, she was just not going to have any of this, you know. Mm. I was not allowed to change. The brand was floral. It was vintage inspired. Like, you know, some people were really kind of angry that I wanted to change and kind of...
Well, I suppose for their market, for them, it worked. And so they maybe felt that...
But that's what's so strange, and especially with this industry, even when it doesn't work, there's still so much resistance to change.
Mm.
Like, there's a store of mine, McMullen's, in San Francisco. She's an incredible woman, and she we were doing an event together, and she's been around for 14 years now, and she said, Tibby is the only brand that I've carried for all 14 years. And she was like, why is that? And I told her, I said, it's because she stayed an independent designer boutique. And so she's allowed her boutique to evolve with her tastes as a woman. And because I stayed independent as a brand, our brand is, because even since I pivoted, like, it still evolves, you know.
Yeah, you sort of grew up together in a
way.
Yeah,
and so have our customers. Mm. So why this insistence that so many brands, that, like, whatever they lock themselves into, that they have to stay that so solidly, when I don't know, I mean, you go back to any high school reunion, like, no one literally looks exactly the same. So why these brands are required to look exactly the same over the course of so many years is crazy.
But we actually have we have quite a few friends who are designers, and we always end up having conversations with them about the power of the wholesaler and how, you know, in a lot of cases it causes a lot of stress and businesses to go under, or people to walk away from their businesses, because there's this constant demand for newness, mm-hmm. and there's constant demand for more, and everyone wants an exclusive, and right. you know, wants their own line. So do you find that challenging? Because obviously you've got quite a pared back, minimal aesthetic, which, you know, there, you must get to a point where you're like, no guys, I've created what I'm going to create this season,
yeah.
and enough.
I crave newness in my closet. So I think that, you know, what I've learned is when a store says, like, they need newness, that what they mean is that, you know, people are coming to shop because they want to feel like they're modern and moving forward. And so for me, when I can figure out in my own closet what the new shape of a sweater is, that will make everything else in my closet feel new when I put it with this new sweater.
I totally agree. And in fact, that's one of the things that when we built Wardrobe Icons, that's one of the reasons why we started, is that as women, we think that there's a biological clock that you get to, say, your late 20s or early 30s, and you just look at your wardrobe and you're like, how have I spent so much money on things that I really don't love, and
right.
I actually cannot wait to get rid of at
right.
the end of each season? And it's such a, well, first of all, environmentally damaging, but also,
yeah.
You know, in terms of building a long-lasting wardrobe, you know, it's what you want pieces in your closet that you love and treasure
yeah.
and wear forever. But I also understand that as much as there is that, once you have those sort of basic pieces,
yeah.
then it's all about finding that, you know, one or two pieces a season that will just make
yeah.
that whole wardrobe work that much harder.
Yeah, and I think, though, what I find, the common mistake that I find with a lot of women is what their notion of a basic is. And that's, you know, for me, like, we have this one thing called the Liam blazer, and it's this blazer that is massively oversized, and we did it in camel, now we did it in navy blue. The thing is, like, that's my basic blazer. And I think that when a lot of people get confused that, like, a basic is, like, a really, you know, a fitted, like, tailored little navy blazer, it's a little tailored black pant, it's a tailored white shirt, but, like, the sweater that I'm wearing with this weird cutout elbow, when you can have a basic that is not a basic at all, that becomes your perfect basic, because then it has personality. Because a basic is supposed to be something that you're supposed to be able to wear every day. And if you wear something every day that has no personality, then you will feel like you don't have a personality.
Well, it becomes a bit more like a uniform
yeah.
then, rather than you having a choice about...
Right, and there are fun uniforms, and then there's really horrible uniforms. And it's... It really, like, whatever you choose to have your uniform should have something really off or interesting about it if you are an interesting person and you want your clothes to convey that.
Yeah.
And we always, you know, I really know that our woman, she dresses so that the clothing shows her personality and not her assets, physical assets, you know. Like, my best customers, when they come out of the dressing room, they're like, does this, like, make me look creative, or does this make me look, like, strong? You know, they don't walk out and say, does this make my boobs look better? You know, that's just not the conversation that I have with them.
And when you did this change in aesthetic with Tibby, obviously you saw massive success with it, mm-hmm. you saw your revenue soar. And with this in mind, would you say that one of the secrets of a business is that maybe that you should follow your gut, or that you should go with what you think? Or?
I do. I mean, I think that, I mean, it's funny. The good news is right now that being authentic is a trend. So that's a good thing. Like, we're very on trend in that respect. But I think that it's much easier to be authentic if you really are authentic. And so I think that, you know, if anyone is looking at starting a company, they are going to be, you know, an entrepreneur by nature. And there's no reason to not be authentic, because your audience right now is global. And so when you're, you know, when I started Tibby, it was a little harder to be truly authentic, because I really was appealing to a very narrow group of people if I was having to work within the confines of, like, the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean, you know, just in America. But now that you're a global brand, which anyone starting out today is, if you set up a website, you're a global brand, then you need to be so damn authentic, because, you know, if someone in India or Chengdu or Dubai or London, wherever, if they're looking at your brand, you need to be recognizable. And then you, by being recognized, then the people who you appeal to will find you, and those who you don't appeal to won't come knocking at your door, which is fine, because you don't want the wrong customers knocking on your door. They're a nightmare. Like, it's, you know, you never want to keep trying to appease a wrong customer. The world is a huge place, so by being very clear about what you are, then everyone in this very large world can find you. And to not be clear right now is to be a disaster.
How would you describe your Tibby woman?
She is someone who, like, physically, for what she likes to wear, there are things that are cleaner and definitely modern and not fussy and effortless. But her mindset is that she is a person who really does want to show her personality and how she dresses. And we cater to a lot of women in fields where creativity is admired and desired. And so, and that can be the tech industry, and that can be the movie industry. And, like, on the movie side, it's really not so much actresses that we cater to. It's the women who are the producers, the directors, people who are really busy, and they want to, you know, look strong and smart, and, you know, they're conscious about the world and what's going on around them. They don't want to be stupid with their purchases.
Speaking of customers and so on, Tibby has become a go-to brand for tastemakers such mm-hmm. as Leandra Medine and Tamu McPherson and Pernille. Mm-hmm. And how has that affected the modern fashion business?
I think it's really great, because, you know, when I was talking earlier about how important it is to be authentic and have a point of view, well, you know, for everyone that follows Tamu, there's someone else who follows someone else. And I think that, you know, who would maybe they would identify with better. And I think that what these influencers have done is they've created all these different pockets for people of certain interests to tap into and see what they're liking and what they're, you know, and I know that people feel like they're having a conversation with these influencers when they look at what they're wearing and what they're recommending. And, you know, I think it's good. Like, I think back to when I was in high school, and, you know, if you didn't dress a certain way, you weren't, I'm sure you felt like shit, and, or you wondered why you were strange. And now all you have to do is go on to your Instagram feed, and you've already selected people that kind of subscribe to your way of thinking, and that kind of validates, you know, validates, I'm sure these people feel more validated by what they're doing. If no one feels in high school that just because I didn't like what they were wearing now, that, you know, they've probably got other people that they look at online that do.
And do you think that from a business perspective that they have sort of opened up that maybe another audience to you that maybe wouldn't have discovered you through normal routes?
Well, for Tibby, for sure, because, you know, we were never, ever... I mean, we were never a magazine darling or anything like that. You know, I mean, you know, for sure, like, my first 15 years in business, Vogue, like, look at the CFDA Awards or Vogue, you know, it was like the same group of guys over and over and over again, right? I mean, still, I even picked up a Vogue the other day, and I'm like, it's still the same. And so... you aren't going to break into that being a young independent brand, and so for sure having this very global platform between influencers, and then also, you know, all of a sudden, like, Net-a-Porter and Matches and Browns, they function like magazines as well.
Yeah.
And so that has helped me tremendously. There's no way I would be here talking to you if I didn't have that backing from influencers.
But speaking of Instagram, you have an incredible Instagram platform, and you give fantastic outfit advice to working women.
Thank you.
How do you, you know, part of that is that you sort of describe them how to dress in an interesting way for mm-hmm. work. How important do you think it is what you wear in the business world?
I mean, I think that in any world, that what you wear makes you feel a certain way. And if it doesn't make you feel a certain way, fine, that's good. Like, I can't be everything to everyone. I'm not pretending to know what every single person thinks, because everyone obviously thinks differently. But I do know that there is a very large group of women that when they put on something creative and interesting, their spine, you know, goes, they just stand taller, they feel better, they feel stronger. And so I would say that if you know that clothing can impact the way that you feel, then use clothing to make yourself feel better. Like, why not?
In terms of business advice that you were given when you started out, is there any piece that you think was like the best that you really take on
board? Honestly, the best advice was that, you know, one guy told me very early on, he's like, you know, if someone like Bloomingdale's walks in and says, I'm going to give you an order for 200,000 pieces, if you can't afford to absolutely eat every single thing that you've produced for them, because, you know, if you don't ship it on time, they'll ask you for a discount. If they don't sell it, they're going to return it. So you have to make sure that you can absorb every single, you know, piece back before you take that first order. Like, thank God that guy told me that, because they did get cut, walk in and do that. And I told them no. And other people who, you know, other smaller stores that came in and did like 20,000, like, for some of those, I did end up eating those orders. I had some mistakes. I didn't know what I was doing in a lot of areas in the beginning. And Bloomingdale's would have put me out of business in week one. I mean, they almost put me out of business in year 10. So I don't believe in biting off more than you can chew. And that's probably kept us small. And I do appreciate risk. I like taking risks, but I also like staying in business. So it's kind of a careful balance.
Yeah. So is that the advice that you would give to someone who's starting out a fashion line or business?
I mean, I would tell them that you take one day at a time. You got to do stuff every single day. You have to keep moving forward. You have to know that you're going to work so hard. You're going to work so hard. But I was the type that even at American Express, like, I was constantly thinking about stupid credit cards in the middle of the night. Like, you know, like, it was plastic and I was thinking about it in the middle of the night. So I think that being an entrepreneur is for people who have, like, a big capacity to work and enjoy working. You know, you really have to enjoy it. And if you don't, you'll become a bitter, horrible person. Just be true to yourself. Don't overthink things. And then do know when to cut bait. This entrepreneurship is not a place for perfectionists. Entrepreneurs should hire...
Laura Fantacci, did you hear that? It's not a place for perfectionists.
But entrepreneurs should hire perfectionists. So you always want them on your team, but the entrepreneur should not be the perfectionist. You'll never get off of the ground, ever.
Thank you very much, Tibby. It was a lovely conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
The sentiment that really resonated with me following my chat with Amy was all about trusting your own instincts. What I really admire about Amy's story is that she's always stuck to her gut, even when this has meant not matching up to other people's expectations. And that ethos has steered her towards success. Staying true to oneself wins every time, and that's such a valuable lesson to take away. Thanks for listening to iConversations. Turns out talking never goes out of fashion. You can find more episodes of these insightful conversations with women who inspire us on Apple Podcasts. Please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps getting the word out.